Hi, you know, this week what I wanted to do, and maybe I'll do this down the road a little bit too, on interviews that I have that maybe need a little explanation, I'm going to do a little intro going into it. And in this case, I want to talk about Judy Johnson, my guest this week. I've known Judy for a few years, ever since she first let me know that they hold this thing called an ancient artifacts archaeologists conference, where they get together with a group of people, some of them all different parts of the world, that seem to have found some different things that just don't add up. And regular science doesn't want to admit to it. They pretty much want to ignore it. Yet these people keep pressing on, and they keep finding arrowheads or spears from the Bronze Age that showed up in parts of this country which shouldn't be here. And also Celtic rock gardens and with the stones, you know, and prayer stones and just things that should not be here, but they are. And how do you explain these? Well, most people choose to just dismiss them as opposed to trying to explain them. So that's what her group does. Once a year they get together, and people from all different parts of the world will talk about different artifacts. Some of you, like myself, might believe that there was a continent called Atlantis. Whether or not this relates to that, some of it is kind of, in my opinion. So I find this interesting. Maybe lets us know that we don't know everything. We certainly don't. And if you can accept that, there are other things, whether it's the paranormal or the unknown or self-awareness, there are things we just don't know about. And an open mind is a good thing. Certainly not a mind that's just going to follow blindly. I totally understand if you have a little bit of skepticism. Also, we're going to talk about pyramids. And what are those things? Like I've asked earlier, I think Judy's got a real good explanation. And she actually has quite the story. She's got quite a story towards the end of this interview to tell you about. I guess I'll let you hear it. That might fall more in the line of paranormal. So I think we got a pretty good program lined up, especially if you're looking for scientific approach to what might be something a little bizarre.
Welcome to Out There with TJ Ryan. It's strange. It's unusual. It's mysterious. It's out there. And now your host, TJ Ryan.
Finally able to talk to somebody. You know, I've been wanting to get to this and I just haven't done it. One of these days, they had the 4th Annual International Conference on Ancient America. They've held this in a town called Big Bay, but this year I guess they had it in Marquette at the Holiday Inn. And Judy Johnson coordinates a lot of it. She's involved with a lot of people that belong to this. How are you doing, Judy?
Real well. I've survived the weekend rather nicely. I had some good support, and the energy of the conference just keeps you up.
Now, before we get to any of that, tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you're involved with this conference.
I live in Scandia with my husband, Glenn Devlamek, who is also on the board for AAPS, along with Fred Reedholm, who is our president, Glenn's vice president, I'm secretary, Dave Callio is treasurer. We have a lot of local people and even some from farther afield who are on the board. Then we have some advisors who are even farther afield. And it's been a slow grow, but it's growing, and we're getting...
This is the 4th annual. Is that how long you've been around?
No, we'd been together in various forms before this, probably about 94, maybe, 5. We started gathering. I had introduced my husband to Fred Reedholm. Glenn was a fan of Fred's, and he was just tickled pink when I told him that he was an old family friend of ours, and he was just getting connected and studying on his ancient copper, which he's just learned so much more about since then and written a fabulous book.
What is the name of
Copper?
Michigan Copper.
Yeah. And then we formed a little group called PCCRS, Pre-Columbian Cultural Research Society. It was very casual. We went on excursions and stomps through the woods to look at old copper pits and possible mounds and just looking and exploring. And
okay, now so... to kind of get to an idea for the people that might be listening that have never heard of this before, and I'm guessing a lot of people haven't, because you probably don't get a lot of international press or national press, do you?
I don't know about specifically for our group, but the movement, if you could call it that, is, yes, it's surging throughout the world. And we are still, maybe you could say, a niche group, and we are considered radical and kooky by
right.
some of the mainstream. And it people who are doing this research whose discoveries don't fit the paradigm of, you know, the long-held taught things about our history, our ancient history. They, educators, and they only go so far.
Right.
And the state and government archaeologists, they're rigid, and they have their reasons. Some of it's political, and some of it's financial, and some of it's to keep their jobs because mm-hmm. they have to hold to the line, or they're in jeopardy.
So what you're saying really is that your group, people that have investigated, people that belong to this or are associated, you've discovered some artifacts which just don't add up, is basically what you're
yes.
saying.
They're considered anomalies. They don't fit the long-held line.
An example being, let's get people to understand, you're not talking something that was found hundreds of years ago, but something that was found thousands of years ago.
Thousands. Well, this sort of explains it in the United States anyway. Back in the 1850s, a man named Powell with the Smithsonian, with all good intent and in support of the Native Americans, drew a line in the sand and said, there were no explorers here before Columbus. And that has been held to for so long. And anything that anybody finds that's an anomaly that is different, that says, wow, here's something that looks like it's Norse or Asian or Mediterranean, Egyptian, Phoenician, African, but it doesn't belong here. So it's been either thrown back in the hole on a dig or brought to a museum by well-intentioned people and then disappeared or put in the basement, but it doesn't fit.
So these are actual artifacts, like they could be, what, stones or arrow tips or?
Yes, points which could include arrows, spears, and then tools of various sorts, fishing tools, hammering tools. But the stones, you mentioned stones. The stones are very intriguing because they can be in many forms.
Like
one
prayer stones.
A dolmen, D-O-L-M-E-N, and that's a standing stone where it's usually a large boulder on top of three smaller stones, and its positioning is significant. If you find one dolmen, there's another one somewhere not too far away that it relates to. There's some kind of a marking, directional thing. We don't really know why they are where they are.
Mm.
Now, people who know from numbers and science and astronomy and alignments and equinoxes and all of that stuff, which I just have a bare understanding of, they can figure those things out, and they oftentimes relate to equinoxes. Spring and fall, and it has to do with timing. No, it's calendars. It's how people mark time, and a lot of very complex stone systems were marking time, and they were so precise. I mean, they can compare it to the movement of the stars. I can't even begin to make any sense to tell you about it.
Hmm.
It's complex, and it's stunning in its elegance.
You know what I wanted to ask you, Judy, because I think you and I talked about this before. Didn't they find some kind of like prayer stones?
There was a lovely prayer stone found in the Escanaba River back when, in the 40s maybe. Fred Riedholm would have the accurate story on this. And it was interpreted by Dr. Barry Fell. They sent photographs to him. And it was something like this, a prayer that I may not drown upon these waters. It was the mariner's prayer.
And now, what time era do they believe, and where did that come from?
Wow. It was written in Ogham, O-G-H-A-M, which some pronounce Om, but we have said Ogham and pronounced the hard G. And it's a type of writing that's done with lines, straight lines. And there's different forms of Ogham. Some is if you take a horizontal line and then do various vertical lines touching the baseline, and the way they're grouped are create letters. And those letters then, once related to the proper language, if it's related to Norse, sometimes Native American, sometimes Hebrew, but you have to figure out which language they are writing that script to. But it's kind of an international language, and it's found all over the world. We saw some presenters this weekend who showed Ogham all over the place. Uh-huh. Ida Jane Gallagher from North Carolina, she has been studying epigraphy for years and years, and she did a program on Ogham, and it's all over the place. It's on pottery. You can find it.
Do they know where?
In plain sight, in museums.
Do they know where this originates?
I don't know. That's sort of the question, is what peoples did this? Was it one people? Was it many people? Was it an international way of communicating?
So we really don't know if this is a stone that was brought over from, and it's this was like estimated to be thousands of years old?
Oh, the one found in the Escanaba?
Yeah.
Don't know. They're thinking probably that it was Norse. I think because of something else, the name of the writer was on there, and it was a Norse name.
And how old would this stone be? Any idea? Don't know?
I'd hesitate to tell you because it would probably be wrong.
Okay.
But we're talking over 1,000, probably over 2,000 years before Christ. Anyway.
That's what I'm searching for, these kind of things. And this is what I want people to know. The average person tuning into this podcast probably has no clue. I don't know if they've ever heard of this before. What got my attention before, Judy, a couple years ago, was trying to promote this conference that you've had now for 4 years. And you sent me some information, and I talked to you on the radio. And what caught my interest is that there seems to be some support and evidence of thousands of years ago of people traveling to this country, not only leaving stones and spears, bronze-type spears, that those kind of things from a different age, but as I recall, there was mining going on.
Mm-hmm. This is why the Upper Peninsula is so significant. This place had some of the most, probably the most pure copper in the entire world, and an abundance of it, not tons, millions of tons, perhaps billions of tons. There are thousands and thousands. There's at least 40,000 pits, small pits, on Isle Royale alone. And a lot of it didn't even require a dig because it was laying right there. The glaciers left many gifts of pure copper, just dropped them off, scraped the tops a little bit, and they could just be removed. They could be hammered out with tools and then sort of pounded into what they called, it would be like, it related something to do with sheep.
Well, you know what? We're going to take a break. I'm going to let you think about that. And part of the reason that I'm doing this interview, I don't know if you see this the way I do, those of you listening, but our history maybe isn't quite what we think, and maybe we're missing some things. And either they've been forgotten or they've been removed, whatever way you want to look at it. But there's some truths out there that are hidden, and that's what we're getting at with this interview. Judy Johnson, my guest, will continue in just a moment on Out There.
Out There. Out There. Out There. Out There.
If you'd like more information about Judy Johnson and the group that she's with, that the Ancient Artifact Preservation Society, there's a website. It's aaapf.org. That's AAAP as in Paul, F as in Frank.org. You will note that there's many different things that you can look at and check out. And you can even contact them. If you have something unusual, perhaps, that you found that could be an artifact, get a hold of them. The website is AAAPF.org.
It's Out There. Out There. Out There. Out There.
All right, segment two of Out There. My guest, Judy Johnson, she's from a place called Scandia. It's, again, in Upper Michigan, and it's probably less than an hour from where I'm at talking to her today. It's nice of you. It's nice to hear from you again, Judy.
Thank you, TJ. It's lovely to talk with you. It's always a pleasure.
You know, I don't think I got a chance to talk to you last year, but you're more than welcome to promote. I'd be glad to help you. Here's what I like about what's being said, and I don't have all the facts, but I really believe the history that we have is not an accurate history. And the more we can learn about our history, some of the real things that are going on, and if you want to take a scientific approach, that's probably the best way. And then it starts to tell us who we maybe really are. Is that kind of why you like this, Judy, or are you just into all this?
Heck. Why am I into it? It started because of my husband, who was an archaeological field tech in California, and he was a fan of Fred's, and it all went there, surrounding around Fred.
But this is a different group of archaeologists. These are kind of like the outsiders, or the, what did you call yourself? The people that... kind of the fringe, or what are the, what?
Yeah, we've been called fringe and worse.
But you're looking at it scientifically, but the rest of the majority of the archaeological world is not probably viewing it the same way.
Well, we've tried to get more professional about it so that we can be taken seriously by the people who follow all the rules. And we are amateurs, some of us. Some of us are more professional than that. Amateur comes from the word amour, which is for the love of it. So it's not a slam to us to
no.
be called an amateur.
Heck no. But what interests me about it is the fact that they may have been mining copper and bringing it to other parts of the world thousands of years ago.
Yes.
And how do you think that comes about? And was there somebody that maybe has more of an understanding on that? There was a fellow you wanted to mention?
One of the reasons why our education has gotten so limited in this country is because Mr. Powell from the Smithsonian drew a line that said nobody was here before Columbus. And in about 1850s, he said this. And that's been the hard line through all the state archaeologists, college archaeologists, federal archaeologists. And it's been a real tough line to get past. But there's way, way, way too much evidence to hold to that anymore. Even the Smithsonian is coming around, and I heard somebody on TV a few weeks ago saying that the Clovis points were found. This is a certain kind of stone and style of carving of points that go on spears and arrows that were found in southern France and found in the Americas down near the Carolinas, Virginia, and fanning out into the country. And this man, bless his heart, said that people came from Europe about 10,000 years ago. That's a long time. And he says that they followed the edge of the glacier, which was still covering most of Scandinavia and the northern parts of the British Isles, and they followed the ice to North America and then on down the coast. And so there we are. We have a Smithsonian guy saying, yes, yes, much earlier than Columbus now. Mm-hmm. So that's a breakthrough. In other countries, their histories, China, British Isles, the Scandinavian countries, their history has them coming here much, much earlier than Columbus. So,
do you think that people, ancient civilizations, do you think that they were more advanced than we give them credit?
Very much, in that they were closer to what's happening with the earth and with the skies and the stars and the tides and... They were very wise and able to do things. I don't know if they did it actually with numbers, but they certainly had a way to set up some very complex systems of stones and lining them up with equinoxes. And we're so disconnected now. We're inside buildings, inside cars. Our feet aren't on the ground very much, and we don't need to measure time by the stars. So we don't. So
we don't.
We've lost a lot of that. And
we
it
don't
takes
need
a
to.
Lot of wisdom to do those kinds of things.
We don't need to set up like calendars like the Aztecs and the Mayans, I believe, also.
Sure. They all had calendars of some sort.
And they were connected. They knew when to plant and when.
Yes.
And all of that guided their life.
Guide their lives.
So getting back to the mining.
The mining.
Does there seem to be like some kind of evidence?
Before we go away there, I wanted to talk about the Native Americans, and because Powell thought he was doing something good for the Native Americans, because he thought if anybody was saying that there were people here of other nations, of other cultures before Native Americans, that would somehow displace them. Not at all. It was incorporative. There are records of Native Americans participating with it. Sometimes it's written in stone or in epigraphy. Two different, very distinct dress costume, Native American, obviously, and then something foreign-looking. And they're there together. So whatever we're doing is very inclusive of Native Americans. Right. So that said, we can proceed.
Okay. Getting back to the mining of the copper.
Back to mining of copper. Michigan, Upper Peninsula mining of copper is so powerful, so significant in the development of metallurgy over the world. It's highly postulated that our copper built the Bronze Ages.
That's pretty amazing if you can join that together as far as, and that would have to go back thousands and thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
When there was no belief that you could actually get here to be able to do that.
The getting here, that's another cute thing, because it was the common people who were told the world is flat and that there's monsters over there, and the mariners have always known the world was round.
Isn't that something? Now, there's a myth right there. If that's true, what you're saying, and you would think it was, because once a mariner went out, he would realize he could keep going.
Yeah.
And so the myth that, oh, the world was flat, and you know, that's what we're taught in history. How many other things in history have we learned in our regular history classes that could be way off, you know?
I don't know if they were so way off as that they were incomplete.
Hmm.
We try not to think that there's been conspiracies, as people have been doing the best they could for the reasons that they thought was right. And we're just trying to make it clearer.
I'm just looking for conspiracies.
And I'm trying to get past conspiracies.
I'm just kidding.
And there have been plenty of them, enough to make you sick.
I'm just kidding. No, we can certainly stay on that, of course. But what I want the listener to gain out of this is that, you know, this program I host is about kind of searching for through the unknown, you know, and part of a lot of our history really is unknown.
Unknown.
And what does that tell us about who we are? And how do we pull this full circle? Well, I think, you know, we were these simple beings, but yet also complex.
Not so simple.
Right. And we did more things that we thought, you know, that we thought we could actually do. And maybe this connection, like the natives have had in every land, there was a greater purpose for this connection to the earth. And it really served them perhaps better than we are served today.
Mm-hmm. Now, somebody had raised the question of having balance in our conferences between science and spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And when you consider in the ancient days, it was all spirit. Certainly there was the practical, the moving about and the knowing of the stars, but it was all about honoring the gods or God, whatever culture it may be, but it was working with the energies of the earth. And they knew about frequency and the power of thought. Maybe they communicated they didn't have telegraph.
So what are you're saying that it could have been telepathic?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, probably telepathic.
So somebody's sitting over in Europe, and Steve is sent over to North America to do some mining up by Isle Royale. Is that where they did it?
I'm thinking not so much with, those would be the more practical people.
Oh, okay.
That would be more, and the holy people, the people that held that tradition of spirit, of awakening to higher self, to the God within, all of that. And there have always been the holy people among all the cultures as well, the ancient and present day.
So you could call them shamans, you could call them a number of different terms. So the average guy that was mining probably wasn't too holy?
Probably not, but there may well have been a shaman with him.
Perhaps so, on his journey. And you just, how, is there evidence to seem to support any of that?
Lots of evidence. Oxide, that's a name I couldn't think of before. They would pound the copper into smaller things, and they would be about the size of an oxide, and so they came to be called that. And that was something that could be carried, because they couldn't move a several-ton piece of copper. People couldn't do that, so they would chip-chop them off.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do that with those lovely chunks that were just sitting there waiting to be used, taken out and used. And those that were in veins, those were harder to get to, but gee whiz, there was so much everywhere easy to get. You know, why go after the hard stuff, the difficult stuff?
So how did they bring this stuff back?
How did they bring it back? The people in our group, some of them are specialists in waterways, ancient waterways. Waterways have gone up and down, and oceans have gone up and down and back up again. And so they are using astrology, looking at the stars and what their placements were way back when, and if they can somehow identify through scientific testing that this particular artifact can be dated, say, 6,000 years ago. Then you can go back to astronomy and find out what was the star pattern 6,000 years ago. And then other indications of water levels.
So it's possible. I guess my question is, how do they get it from Lake Superior to Lake Michigan and eventually out back out?
There's a couple of ways. One, and you can see it in satellite pictures, from the Keweenaw Bay and the Sturgeon River and down joining Escanaba River. It's not all joined today. Maybe it is by small creeks and things. But if water levels are higher, you can see kind of a groove right down through the midwestern portion of the UP on, right? Oh, shoot.
You got a phone call? We'll take a break. Go grab the phone. You're listening to Judy Johnson. She's involved with International Conference of Ancient Americans. They just had it in Marquette. We'll be back with more in just a moment. Well, we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts on this program or any other program stuff you do like and you're interested in, or if you'd even like to be a guest, maybe you've had some unusual things happen and you wouldn't mind talking about them, you can send me an email at tj2@up.net. That's tj2@up.net. And if you downloaded this from somewhere and you're not sure where this program originates, probably the easiest thing to do is go to www.braverinstitute.com, and then you can click on out there and it takes you to the show.
It's out there.
I'm talking to Judy Johnson. She is from Scandia, Michigan. She's involved with a group of folks that put together an international conference on ancient America. And she was talking how it just seems like the water levels at one time basically would have been high enough to where they would have been able to travel from Lake Superior to Lake Michigan, and then I'm guessing all the way out to the coast, right?
Well, they would go Lake Michigan down through maybe the Chicago River, the Wabash, and then into the Mississippi, and the Mississippi was higher, too.
All the way
through all the way down, which was a more direct route than coming through the St. Lawrence Seaway or up through Canada. And there would be portages required part of the ways, but with the copper down into manageable size of those oxide things, which would be maybe a foot and a half wide by a couple feet long and pounded down thin enough so that it would be of a weight that a man could lift.
Hmm. And so the crafts they used, were they smaller boats?
Don't know.
Okay.
Somebody might know, but I can't tell you.
Now let me ask you this before we run out of time. What were some of the things that were brought up at this conference that you just held? Some of the maybe interesting, really interesting things. Put you on the spot, Judy.
The biggest pyramid in the world is not in Egypt, and it's not making Egypt happy. It's in Bosnia.
In Bosnia.
And it's a group of pyramids with one very large one, much larger than Cheops.
And what is it about the pyramids?
What is it about pyramids? The things that took our breath away, of all the things that Sam Osmanagic showed us in his photos, was not the digs showing some of the chambers or the passageways to chambers. He hasn't got to a chamber yet. And the flat levels with the stones on top of them. I mean, there's lots and lots of indication of man-made activity. But what was the coolest thing was some kind of a scientific energy photo that he took of it, where he had taken pictures of other mountains around and showed the frequencies going sort of nicely in layers, sort of horizontally over these peaks. But over the largest of the pyramids, the energy shot straight up.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. So what do you think these pyramids, in your own theory? Let's just speculate. What do you think they were used for?
They were used eventually for tombs, but I don't think that they were meant that way in the beginning. I think they were power centers.
power centers.
And there are more and more people coming around to that, the scientists who are a lot smarter than I am.
And what do you mean by a power center?
The shape of it created power, created energy and frequencies. And
what would you use that power for?
For what? I don't know. Did they power their towns, their villages with that? Did they use it to enhance the power of the leaders who saw themselves as gods?
Mm.
Did they use it to preserve things that were stored within them? Did they think it would keep the powers of the royalty that maybe eventually were inside, keep their powers great and as they were? You know, people who saw themselves as gods or set themselves up as gods. I don't know.
Now, let me ask you this. And if these might not be great questions, but I'm kind of on the outside of this. So do you think there's any connection? Because I always thought this. You got pyramids in South America. You got pyramids in all over, really.
North America.
Do you think they were connected to or influenced by or some way with the Egyptian or other pyramids in the world?
They're all connected. That's what we're finding out more and more. We used to be sort of picky about how can this speaker connect his area of study way back in Timbuktu with North America and our ancient archaeological research. And we just stopped doing that because it's all connected.
So
some people can figure out that ley lines, which travel the earth, that goes from this pyramid in South America to that pyramid and elsewhere in the world. There's so many alignments. It's stunning.
So there had to be proof, somewhat, in a way, that they were traveling.
Oh, yes.
Back and forth to have all these pyramids.
Yes, they were traveling, definitely traveling.
And some of these pyramids go back thousands of years.
Many thousands.
So that in a way, is evidence. Maybe it's not evidence, but it tells me that how did they all come up with this design? And they had to share it, right?
Yeah.
All these different
societies.
Where
South American pyramids are almost all the step-up kind of pyramids.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, most of them in the world are the step-up kind of pyramids.
Do you guys, just to totally get off the subject, I don't know if this is part of what you do, do you have anything with Atlantis? Do you have any discussion about that?
Yes, it comes up. It comes up. Just about every conference it comes up. And it's a little bit of evidence and a lot of speculation.
What kind of evidence do they throw out for Atlantis? You have anything?
It comes from the writings of which ancient Greek philosopher?
Homer, or was it Homer?
Nope.
Plato. Yeah.
Plato. And he had quite a clear description of it with concentric circles around, and that some of our people have speculated that it's near Gibraltar. There's islands out there, and something significant was that all these elephant bones that Plato talked about, and there were these elephant bones found on an island off of Portugal. But I'm not a very good person to talk to about that because
right.
I'm just sketchy.
I'm curious because you've probably seen and heard a lot, and I just throw a few questions out. Maybe they're not the ones I should be asking, but...
Well, if you want to go into my past life memories, I'd have more to tell you, but that's another show.
Past life memories?
Yes, I've had since I was a child.
Really?
And some of them are making more sense now the more I go to these conferences.
Well, let's talk about that briefly.
Really?
Yeah, tell me a past life memory.
Well, it's always been easy for me to understand, or it just seems logical to me, that when they're speculating about how these pyramids were built, mm-hmm. with these monstrous stones, 20 ton, 30 ton, 40 ton apiece. And Sam Osmanagic of Bosnia has a stone. He's revealed a stone, and they figured it weighs 20 tons. And figuring out how many men it would take to move 20 tons, it would take 500-some men. And that stone's not that big. And he said to a group of people there now, how do you get 500 men to move this stone? And the guy says, I know, you put 200 on this side, you put 200 on this side. But you can't fit 200 men
no.
on the side of a stone.
No, how would you do that?
So, and this based on my past life memory of, I've had two separate ones. One as a child and one as a grown person.
Now, this is just like a vision?
One was a vision that I just had. I had these spontaneous things, awake dreams. Hmm. And I just sort of zone out. And then I have these complex, very, very real visions, like going to the movies, but I'm in the movie. And so I'll go back to the one that came later, but it was my childhood of that time. I would have been about 12, 13, and I was among maybe 30 other children about my age, and we were being trained. And we were sitting on this rounded plateau outside of our city, which I recognized to be the city that I had had a vision of at an earlier time. And so here we are, around in this circle. In the center of us is this hewn stone. The stone might be about 3.5-4 feet long by a foot and a half wide by maybe a foot and a half high. So it's a heavy stone. And we are making harmonics. Some of us are humming. Some of us have flutes. And we're aiming those tones toward the center, toward the rock. And whatever's happening with the frequency of that, the toning, it's raising the stone.
It's raising the stone, lifting it up.
Lifting it up.
Thus, you're connecting, you're telling me this is what they did with the pyramids.
Whether they did it with voice or whether they did it with some other frequency. I think it's frequencies.
Interesting. And you have a memory of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you must be pretty old.
I'm very, very old.
That had to be thousands of years ago.
Tens of thousands of years old.
That lifetime, you're saying.
I'm looking pretty good for 20,000 years old.
You don't look bad, Judy, for 20,000. You really don't. And what was the other one? Didn't you say you had another?
Yes. When I was grown, then I was female that time, and I was working in a healing center, and we called it a healing center. It was shaped like a pyramid, and I would move people. We communicated telepathically, and I would move them to these sort of tables made with semi-precious stones. It could be malachite or lapis or a marble of some sort, and there was frequency in the marble. Or in this lapis. And there was also light coming through squares in the ceiling, where, and they were slanted. I knew it was a pyramidal shape, just the way it was in the inside. And they would be under a certain colored light, too. And so it was the light frequency, and it was a frequency from the stone. And it was a healing thing. I would move them to the proper ones, depending on their need. And then when I walked out of that building and stepped into a street, but there were no wheeled vehicles. The streets were for people to just walk, and there were buildings on both sides. It was.
Did it look fairly modern?
My clothing was just a little white, simple tunic. The dress didn't seem to be spectacular at all. Everybody that I saw there was quite simply dressed, but there was a lot of gems. So anyway, this is what's cool. Looking down the street and up into the hills, there was this mountain. And it was a quartz mountain that had been exposed and faceted. And it was maybe 100 feet across, 150 feet across, this huge, like a giant diamond, faceted, cut into this mountain. And that's how we powered everything we needed power for. There were stubby is what I want to say, stubby little airplanes that flew in front of that crystal. And that's they were getting their power. And I had just gotten done telling Ida Jayden Gallagher at our conference a couple days ago about this memory of mine. And she's a very scientific lady, and she was still okay. She was open to hearing this. And I was talking about this funny little airplane. And then she was out in the hall talking with somebody out in the lobby. And then I was in then looking at somebody's presentation. I'm not even sure what he was talking about, but he was in South American pyramids is what he was, and he showed a picture of an airplane.
Really?
It was right from the drawing on the wall, and I went out, Ida Jane, come in real quick. That's the airplane that I saw.
Wow.
So there it was. It's been on the walls in South America.
And you had never seen that before?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
That's the kind of airplane that I saw flying in front of this giant crystal.
That's pretty interesting. How do you come up with that, Judy? Some people would say, well, come on, she must have seen it before. That's why she dreamt about it. No. Now, do you know, because we have to move along here, wrap it up pretty soon. Just one more question. Do you know what time period this would be? No idea, I'm guessing.
Which time? Oh, my memories?
Yeah.
certainly prehistory.
So you don't know?
Who knows? It's the ancient days. I think
you can't put a date on it.
I think that they were very intelligent, very advanced.
Well, if you're
scientifically
talking
complex, civilizations,
if you're telling
Neanderthals,
if you know. You said you're using telepathy, heck, we can't even do that now.
Some can.
Yeah, maybe some can, but I can't. And so, and most of the world probably doesn't accept telepathy right now. So,
actually, most of the world does. They accept the concept of it.
But they don't believe that people can practice
that.
Exactly. So this tells us that in many ways it was much more advanced than we are, or maybe we just lost our way, right?
You know, I think we're reawakening to that. This is what's exciting about it. Here comes 2012 and all these dire predictions at the end of the world, blah, blah, blah. That's not going to happen. It's the beginning. It's a new beginning.
A new beginning.
The Mayan calendar went to 2012, not because it was the end, but because it was the start of a new calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a time of awakening, and this is where there's a lot of interest in all these phenomena, things from many directions. It's time to know again.
It's time to regain it. You know, with that, we are out of time. And just quickly, your website, if somebody wants to find out more about what we're talking about, do you have that?
It's too? Under our old initials, which is AAA, P as in Paul, F as in Foundation, AAAPF.org.
You can go there, and Judy is going to be back on again because there's many more things outside of what we talked about this time that I'd like. She's written a book. She's got some past life memories. Those of you that maybe believe in reincarnation, she can actually remember some of these things. And she knows how to work with people to help them regress. So that's another thing. Maybe people can come to you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you very much, Judy Johnson from Scandia. I appreciate you being on out there today.
Oh, thanks. It's always a blast talking with you, TJ.
Thank you.
Music on Out There, created by Kevin MacLeod.